Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Tidings podcast, where Gen Z discusses economics, history, and everything in between. Today, we have with us a very, very special guest, Dr. Robert Johnson. Dr. Johnson serves as the president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. He's an international investor and consultant to investment funds on issues of portfolio strategy, who recently served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz. He currently sits on the board of directors of both the Economic Policy Institute and the Campaign for America's Future. What's more is that Dr. Johnson was an executive producer of the Oscar-winning documentary Taxi to the Dark Side. So welcome to the show, sir. It's an absolute honor to speak with you today. I'm so grateful to you for the opportunity.
Oh, the pleasure's mine. Thanks for inviting me.
Now, before we talk about INET, I want to go back even further to ask you, how were you first introduced to the field of economics? What was your first interaction with economics?
Oh, my. Well, I guess I grew up in Detroit, Michigan at the time of what I call a great cauldron, labor management conflict, racial conflict, anti-war. Many people cite the document, the Port Huron Statement, as the kind of signature of the anti-war rebellion. And that statement was written by students from University of Michigan, Tom Hayden and others, and as well as other people. But the anti-war movement, all politics, all economics was very big. Next dimension, the decline of the auto industry. Though my father was a physician and a musician, my mother worked with the Detroit Symphony and other philanthropic things. Many of their friends became very depressed. Many of their friends saw their lives deteriorate very markedly. So I couldn't help but be attentive and observant of political and economic events. Where I first encountered the economics profession was when I took a course at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where I got my undergraduate degrees. And I remember not being a smart aleck about it, but listening to someone talk about equilibrium. And I raised my hand and I said to the teacher, isn't that like assuming a happy ending? Because my formative years in Detroit did not guarantee a happy ending. So I was intending at the time to be a naval architect, a designer of ships. I went to college for engineering because some of the most famous and brilliant naval architects ever went to MIT. But I took an interest in politics and economics with me from Detroit. My parents were very sensitive in that realm. And so I ended up adding as a second major my bachelor degree in economics. And the person who was most inspiring was at the time Charles Kindleberger, the famous author of Manias, Panics, and Crashes. He talked about financial instability and disequilibrium. So I guess I was back at home from the echoes of Detroit when I talked with Kindleberger, and he inspired me to write a paper. I was a big sailor as a kid, about how maritime technology and national strategies influenced the competition between the Dutch and the British for the battle for empire and what you might call the patterns of trade around the world. So economics started to feel like it illuminated things, and there was a very vivacious and charismatic man in Charles Kindleberger as my guiding light.
Thank you, sir. That fits perfectly to my next question, is that after your undergraduate studies at MIT, you went to Princeton University for your master's and PhD, also in economics. So what was that experience like?
Well, at Princeton, it was a very intimate group, like 15 or 18 people. There was some brilliant, brilliant teachers there. William Branson on international finance, Joseph Stiglitz, was recently arrived in 1980, and Alan Blinder, who later became the vice chairman of the Federal Reserve and was an excellent macroeconomist, and many more, Avinash Dixit, Gene Grossman. But what I would say is relative even to MIT, and I was, when I was a kid in sailing, I taught myself aerodynamics, hydrodynamics, therefore calculus, lots of geometry and trigonometry for navigation. So I was quite comfortable with mathematical tools. And when I got to Princeton, there was a tremendous focus on formalism, what I'll call high theory, game theory, and things of that nature. And there was a part of me that was what I'll call more inductive in spirit. So I ended up being able to pass my journal exams, but spending a lot of time at the Institute for Advanced Studies. Albert Hirschman, Axel Leonhufvud, Marcelo Dzecko were there. Hirschman ran it. The others were fellows there that in residence at times. The history department, Arno Mayer, David Abraham, Carl Shorsky, lots of history courses around the times, say from the onset of World War I to the end of World War II, through the Depression, all of the disequilibrium in society. I found a lot of nourishment in those places. I thought the economics department was well organized, the teachers were excellent, but they really were beginning what's become a trend, or at least was a trend for some time in economics. This is the early 1980s, which was not to teach the history of economic thought or economic history as mandatory requirements. And I found that, what you might call dimension, sad. I had worked with Peter Tenman and Charles Kindleberger and my now INET research director, Thomas Ferguson, on political economy, history, and so forth at MIT. And I didn't find as much nourishment until I reached to the history department.
That's really interesting. I'd really like to know about what you thought about the intersection between economics and history. What can the two fields learn from each other?
Okay. Where I would start in exploring that is by saying this. When you're a historian, you have a real problem. You have to diagnose, measure, interpret, and you are inherently multidisciplinary. Sociology, political science, anthropology, psychology, economics, they're all in the toolkit. So it's a multidisciplinary effort that is driven by understanding and explaining, and the tools are the means to the end. When you're in one of the social science disciplines, and you asked about economics, the tendency becomes to defend the methods of the discipline, show where they illuminate things and are powerful, but to kind of suppress the blind spots. And there's a kind of competition between disciplines, say in the realm of labor, understanding labor between sociology and economics, that I think gets in the way of the understanding. And what I find is that the history compels you to bring everything back together. And often because history is looking at the past, though it has precedent and implications for the present future, the wealthy and the powerful are not quite so high pressure. When you're doing public policy going forward, there's a lot of pressure because people in the professions who are known as experts, who want titles, government positions, you know, chairs at universities, they know who they're offending, and sometimes they remain silent. The silences tell you sometimes the map of where power is. But when it's history, even if it's being used, and it often is, for interpreting now and projecting into the future, and history can be badly misused, but there is a little more openness to bring all the tools together and not have to, quote, purify your brand by only practicing the methods in the narrow discipline of either economics or psychology or political science, whichever one is interfacing with history.
Next, are there any favorite classes that you can recall at Princeton?
Oh, favorite class? Yeah. Yes, without question. In my second year, and there are many that I liked, I can go on, but there's one that really stands out. In my second year, four of us took a year-long general towards, you know, we had to pass a general exam, called Advanced Theoretical Economics. And it was four of us with Joseph Stiglitz. And Joe Stiglitz would walk in, not with a heavy reading list, not going through papers, but talking about problems and exhibiting how to derive what to say, what to see, how to specify a model and so forth. And we did this over and over and over again over the course of the year. And so what I said was that Joe Stiglitz wasn't teaching you the literature. He was teaching you courage, camaraderie, and creativity, the three C's. And it was a brilliant, brilliant and fun. Sometimes it was, you know, struggling and you could feel embarrassed, but it was fun. And Joe was encouraging. He was a very gentle and uplifting kind of what you might call persona to be learning from and mentored by. And what I remember most was after we'd been through and all these different things over the course of the year and my colleagues and I, the four of us, were all studying for our general exam. We walked in. You sat down at your desk. You turned over the paper. Here's the general exam. And it said, for all your life, what you've been doing is reading other people's work and trying to understand the discipline. But I'm sure that in recent months, you've been starting to think about your future, which is producing new and innovative research. What do you have in your mind about what the economics profession hasn't done that you would like to build on? In other words, in the next 3 hours, let's get a head start on what you're going to do in the future and leave the past behind. And so you're sitting there like, this has nothing to do with what I prepared for months, except it did with regard to, let's see a little courage and creativity out there and, you know, critique of the discipline. Where were the holes, the blind spots, the misspecifications, and what are you going to do about it? And I thought the genius of that general exam was a fantastic way to finish the training. That was my last general exam before moving on to the PhD dissertation writing. But that was just a fabulous course and a fabulous exercise. If you're interested in others, there were Alan Blinder. I was the TA for his macro course because he was on leave the year I took first year macro. And I will tell you that if anybody were to nominate the Nobel Prize for the person with the best sense of humor, improvisational sense of humor, I think Alan Blinder would be the unanimous winner. He was fun, funny, and it wasn't just random goofiness. It was always related to the context and the interaction of the day. But it really invigorated the spirit of the course and the affection that all of the students had for working with him.
Now, coming on to INET, can you tell us about how and why the Institute for New Economic Thinking was formed and how it's evolved over this past decade?
Well, I think it's fair to say that the Institute was spawned by the great financial crisis. And I think the feeling, particularly, you know, because the so-called TARP, Troubled Asset Relief Program, was in the making, that a lot of people saw the bailout as something that was not healthy, as Joe Stiglitz said. The post got paid and the population was going to suffer. What others called the mother of all moral hazards existed. And then you had George Soros, who I used to work with as a partner in the Soros Fund Management, who had written books like The Alchemy of Finance and had a very different, what you might call a vision of finance, which we might say embodied radical uncertainty, the unknown unknowns. Whereas orthodox finance saw it as an exercise in dynamic programming with a known terminal equilibrium condition. And then you just, what the mathematician said, put in backward induction and get back to the current prices and everything's stable and on course. And so after the TARP legislation passed, a man named Robert Duggar, another named Anatole Kaletsky, who's on my board, and myself were talking. Duggar and I had both worked with the Senate Banking Committee and he had worked with the House Banking Committee. And we were down in Washington in the trenches during that legislation. And we talked with Soros, who grew up in Hungary. And he grew up at a time when the Nazis had invaded. And it was very traumatic. And he has written a lot about this. But what he said at the time to us was, when you really look at the turning point for the rise of Nazi Germany, the financial crisis of 1931 in Austria and Germany really accelerated things, and that there will be a loss of confidence in finance, a loss of confidence in the kind of elites, a loss of confidence in expertise and in governance, and we should found an institution to challenge the ideas, but not just to be a critic or despondent, but to fill the void with some healthier way to look at it and healthier way, how would I say, to recommend social design and laws, regulations, enforcement, etc., to manage the interface between the financial system on the one hand and the society at large on the other, and that something has come, you might call, quite far out of balance was the essence or the driver of the impetus to start INET. It sort of echoed, though preceded, it echoed what became called the Queen's Question. How did you guys not see this? And it was in that blind spot and in the potential ramifications that Soros and I assembled. I traveled around the world talking to economists, and then Soros and I assembled, I think it was 30 or 31 leading economists, including 7 Nobel laureates, for a retreat for a weekend, the last days of September in 2009, to discuss not the financial situation, but to discuss the nature of the economics profession. And to put it simply, after those 3 days, Soros and I had lunch, and he said, "Oh, I think this profession's in much worse shape than I even imagined. We got to do this." So we set the course with the first conference in April at King's College, Cambridge, a place where Hayek and Keynes had been in residence at times, Keynes most definitely. And we set for that, rallying cry to the people in the profession. People like Kenneth Rogoff and Joe Stiglitz and Thomas Ferguson and Robert Skidelsky, Bruce Caldwell, who's a great scholar of Hayek. And we went to work, and then commissioning research, that first conference, holding convenings, creating affiliations with universities like Oxford or Cambridge or USC or Princeton, all down the tracks. And cultivating in slow motion at the beginning. The first part was about ideas, but then cultivating a group of young people, which came to be called the Young Scholars Initiative about 2 years later, when we did a conference in Berlin, and which you might call trying to help fortify the curiosity and the confidence of the young people and help them become the leaders of a better economics in the future.
That's incredible, sir. Now, you've had a very long relationship and experience with economics. My next question is, what is one common myth about the field of economics that you would like to debunk?
Well, I think I'll say that there are three that are all at the head of my concern. One is that the future is known and knowable. I believe that notion we call radical uncertainty, or philosophers called ontological uncertainty, is the context in which we operate. The degree of it can vary through time, but I think that's important to acknowledge that dimension of the challenge. The second is that politics and economics are not separable. While at times you can illuminate this or that phenomena as being, the driver or what's more important, it's my view that the interaction between politics and economics, particularly when it gets out of kilter, can create a great deal of social discord and breakdown and disruption. And in particular, the notion in a democratic society that the economy is a structure, is a tool, is of service, is a means to promote social well-being, and that it gets its moral legitimacy from being governed by democracy, breaks down when what I call the commodification of social design takes place. And what I mean by that is that when the rules, the laws, the regulations, the enforcement, the appointments of people are controlled by money and politics, particularly in a period when you have a highly concentrated distribution of income and wealth. These things are demoralizing to a society, and they foment despair. As the famous columnist with the Financial Times, Martin Wolf, has been writing about recently, that despair leads to what he would call a hard or a demagogic type of populism based on fear and hostility, and runs the risk of an authoritarian response and a breakdown in governance and many of the principles that people hold dear. So that pretend that markets are separate from politics, I think, is quite dangerous in its potential. And then the third is one which I find very important, and that is we do normative economics by acting like the market takes what we desire through our preferences, which are cast in stone, into something called demand, and the market satisfies that with incentives, supply, prices, and so forth. And while there's an element of that that's true, the simplicity of the modeling, or the what I'll call presuppositions regarding the psychology of an individual and where they derive their ideas, their preferences, their desires from, is a lot less stable, and it requires what I'll call some multidisciplinarity in realms of psychology, and what you might say the normative moral clarity of a market system becomes somewhat less clear. And I think it's important to pay attention to that, which you might call behind. We often in economics use scientific method as a way to assert a certain superiority within the profession. But a lot of these building blocks, what I call the presuppositions, the maintained hypotheses, like preferences of a consumer and what is inside their utility function, I think those are not scientifically derived. Basically, those are the three things that I find most misleading about when society has to make, how do you say, wrestle with the moral dilemmas related to our well-being.
Next, I would like to move on to more sort of personal questions to, if you're comfortable talking about those, to get to know about your experiences and things that have transformed you along the way.
Okay.
So firstly, I want to talk about music. You know, I had the great pleasure of attending the social event last month at the Plenary, organized by INET, where you shared a beautiful playlist with incredible songs. So how did this admiration for music begin, and how has it impacted you?
Well, first of all, my father was a very brilliant pianist, jazz pianist. My mother had been a choral singer with the Detroit Symphony. She became a director of development. Money raising and support for the symphony. They were immersed. When I was a little one, I did not ever go through Christmas without seeing the Nutcracker Ballet. There was always music in my house. My father, often when I came home in the afternoon from sports practice, I'd go take a shower, and when I'd come downstairs, my dad would be playing the piano. My mom would be in the kitchen preparing dinner, singing along. I always tell people I could tell what dinner was going to be like from listening to my father's left hand on the piano, the one that's more rhythmic and chord-like. My mother, whether she was playing along with him, I could see if they were getting along. I could see all these things. And so music felt both invigorating. It was like a language in my home, but it also felt pretty close. It was something you could discern a lot of what is truthful about your environment and your experience from the music. Secondly, being in Detroit, which was, as I mentioned earlier on, a bit of a social cauldron, the kind of music like Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, Aretha Franklin singing, all of these things could play into your mind, and they resonated with what you experienced. And I didn't even have to go to We Almost Lost Detroit by Gil Scott-Heron, which was about a near avoidance of a nuclear accident at the Enrico Fermi plant, which was south of Detroit down near Toledo, that could have created a nuclear disaster like Chernobyl or other things, similar malfunctions that lost a lot of life. But there was, it's just music is, and poetry kind of always penetrated to the heart of the situation, to the heart of the matter, as they say. In my own life, I spent time after leaving finance, I founded a music company and had a blues and roots label and worked a lot. Then I started working in documentary film and music management. I enjoyed, as much as anything I've ever done professionally, I enjoyed being in the studio with musicians and improvising around what was going on. Like if somebody's son or daughter called and an artist got irritated, I could figure out a song in our repertoire that would reflect those emotions. People, when they are playing live, often are very radiant. When they're recording, they're scared because they're creating something that will be on record for life. And so to break them out of their fear, not by being literal, but using the catalysts of the experiences that arise inside the studio, can sometimes inspire them to reach further than their self-protecting instincts would have allowed them to do. And I found that playing in that context in that kind of role of a delightful challenge.
That's incredible, sir. Next, I would like to ask you the question that I had the honor of asking Professor Robert Skidelsky at plenary last month. That is, what are you curious about right now? What are some questions that intrigue you?
I think in my mind at the moment, the tensions of social sustainability and the relationship between governance, economic structure, the distribution of power, the collective institutions that we have to create and nurture and sustain are very, very critical to avoiding social breakdown, wars, and things of that nature. The second thing that I think is very important now is to reestablish the nature of how expertise gains trust and license to represent not just the national, but the global public good. When we began to privatize everything, I'll stay from the Reagan-Thatcher years on, the notion of expertise ran the risk of becoming marketing for power rather than insight and illumination for the global good. And people had to wrestle with this in terms of their career ambition and development, survivability, what kind of things they could get published in, what kind of consulting agreements they could make to support their families and what have you. Civil servants, I always quickly kind of talk about the Singapore model. Excellent training, high salaries, so you don't have to change jobs, and very, very nourished budgets and systems for the act of governance. And, you know, people get afraid of that because we've seen authoritarian and demagogues take advantage of society. But by making what you might call your senior civil servants subject to the revolving door so that their kids can go to college, revolving door meaning having to go to the private sector and serve the people that they governed, gives them a set of incentives that are quite at odds with representing the people who have paid for their salary in government. And I think the public would be better served to pay them a little more so they don't have to be responsive to the revolving door. But all of those things, obviously, the specter of climate, the handling of disease, the pandemic, These are acute questions, but they all, you know, how we pay for the research for pharmaceutical product development, vaccine development, who gets paid and who owns these things, these intellectual property rights, and how does that affect the dissemination and distribution? If you said you want a COVID vaccine and company could charge you $100,000, a few rich people could get it. But the problem is you need to inoculate all of society to stop the propagation of the pandemic. So I don't know how the interface between public and private is to be managed in these new forms of not only disease, but in the context of globalization and the interaction or weakness or whatever of each nation state. How do all these things play out? I just made a wonderful podcast with a man named Seth Klein, brother of the famous Naomi Klein. And he talked about the war mobilization in Canada. But during the podcast, I said to him, yeah, that's great, but the Canadians do the right thing and the rest of us don't. Then we're all exterminated and maybe you guys get the first best chairs in heaven or something. But it's very hard. It's very hard to, this isn't just, you know, corrupt versus good. These are challenges with all kinds of cross currents that are very difficult to deal with. And I think that that interface that we call political economy is at the center of it.
Definitely, sir. My next question is, what is something, according to you, that needs to be changed in the way we study and look at economics?
Well, I believe we need a much more supple model of what people aspire to be, yearn for, the notion of what is not just physical, but emotional and mental well-being has to be understood. In other words, if we're in service of humanity, what's good for humanity at the starting gate is an important question. I think the way in which I would approach that teaching is not just to take courses in clinical psychology. I think there's a lot of literature I might call wisdom literature. You know, Seneca and the Stoics and some Aristotle and maybe Bob Dylan's lyrics. And but there's a sense in which that deeper kind of knowing is important. I think the use of history and the history of ideas, but not the history of ideas as which you might call modules dropped from Mars. You want to study the history of economic ideas in the context of the history, the vested relationships at the time, the challenges that society faced at that time, the potential from innovation, because these ideas may be good and not prevail in the tug of war with power, or they may be illuminating and catalyze a transformation that others subsequently agree with but didn't see coming. So I think seeing history and seeing ideas interactively, where the inspiration to ideas comes from the context, but the context evolves in response to inspiring ideas, that dynamic process, I think, is something that economics, Greg Mankiw, who I knew when I was at Princeton, he was a very brilliant undergraduate before going to undergraduate school. So I can tease him, but I always say that there's this kind of sense in economics that we have a Darwinistic process with the survival of the fittest, and the best, the brightest, the fittest is what you see in Greg Mankiw's textbook. I think the process is a lot more complicated than that. I'm not denigrating Greg's textbook. That's not the point, but it's not as if we know the economics now is better than it ever was, as if we're on some kind of linear upslope going to higher and higher levels of understanding. I know Jeffrey Sachs at Columbia University now is writing a book about how when we formalized economics, made a lot of modeling assumptions, that we broke away from the sensitivity and the texture of ethical reasoning or ethical philosophical exploration, and maybe made some mistakes in how we treat mankind. So I think that there's a lot of breathing of humanities back into economics that will help us make better decisions.
I would just like to follow up on something that you said that is really intriguing to me and sounded very unique, because I've never heard anyone mention this before. I'm personally a huge fan of Stoic philosophy. I've been reading a lot of Marcus Aurelius, Seneca. What do you think we can learn from this Stoic philosophy that can be applied to the way we think about economics?
Well, I think I don't want to be disrespectful of quality minds, because there are many economists who are very brilliant people and intuitively brilliant people. But I do believe, let's just say, if you read someone like Montaigne, the feeling that you get of the not knowing an exploring and unfolding of what matters. It's not the same as saying we have goods A and B and they have relative price and you eat this or you eat that, and that's what a human needs. In other words, by making everything material, by making everything individual rather than, how would I say, I had too much to eat last night, I'm glad somebody else can eat this morning that's hungry. In other words, the intertwined nature of well-being, that we matter, not just me matters. The characterization of everything around me is what I will call a fearful misspecification of what really creates a good life. And so I think if you penetrate into these people, I mentioned Montaigne, you mentioned Marcus Aurelius and Seneca and others, you get into that exploration. If you read Shakespeare, the dilemmas there, if you read Dante's Inferno, if you read Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, it takes your imagination to places that is difficult to turn off as you explore what matters in life thereafter. And I think that's a gift. It's a gift that you earn by undertaking the exploration, but I think it stays with you.
That's absolutely brilliant, sir. Thank you so much. My next question is that what are some prominent books, podcasts, movies, or even music that help you build your interest in economics that you would recommend somebody else to check out?
There's a really interesting book by a man named Robert Patterson called The Triumph of Vulgarity. And it was a little bit like, how would I say this? It was about the rock and roll era. It was a book that kind of, what you might call, insinuated that you have sort of an upper class and they want order because basically they're in good shape. And that when people rebel against it, using classical English literature and the more vulgar breaks down the reverence for the ideal of the upper crust. And so I thought that book was very good. I thought the record and the song, What's Going On, by Marvin Gaye, who was a patient of my father's medical practice in Detroit. I thought that was genius. And I thought it actually changed the course of Motown music to a much more socially aware representation rather than what you might call just leisure and play. It embraced the heart space of social concern. I think Bob Dylan has songs, many, many songs, like A Rolling Stone, How Does It Feel to Be on Your Own with No Direction Home? It's All Right, Ma, I'm Only Bleeding. Ballad of a Thin Man, There's Something Happening Here and You Don't Know What It Is, Do You, Mr. Johnson? That's radical uncertainty right there. So I think that similarly with film, with visual images, I think The Wizard of Oz is tremendously illuminating. Is there no place like home? Oz, O-Z, move forward one letter, N-Y. It's from N-Y, N goes to O, Y goes to Z. Was Oz the parable of New York? People migrating away from the farm. People used to have children in order to have a labor force to plant and harvest and feed them as they got older. And then their children all migrated away, seeking greater fortune in the cities. I don't know. But I think the author, L. Frank Baum, was paying attention to what the sources of discord, discomfort, unsustainability. There's a woman named Muriel Rukeyser. She wrote a wonderful book I'd recommend to everybody. It's called The Life of Poetry. And the first part of it is called The Resistances. And she talks about during the war, having to get on a ship in Europe because the Germans were bombing, I think it was somewhere in Scandinavia, and sail across the ocean. And she was a poet and she thought she could read her poems and cheer people up. But people didn't want to open up because they were so afraid as they were evacuating their homeland. And so she found what she called the resistances to poetry. And the first one is called The Fear of Poetry. about letting things in when chaotic structural change is upon you and you wish for order, you yearn for order. So I think there's a lot of powerful energy contained in the arts. Listening to Aretha Franklin, the opening of a movie I was one of the co-producers of called Amazing Grace. The opening song is Holy, Holy. That's a Marvin Gaye song, but she modifies it. And as she sits down with this beautiful gospel-trained gift for call and response, interaction with a choir and an audience, she lets out, we've got to believe in each other's dreams. And you can just see in this church, in this movie, it's a live concert where it was recorded in Los Angeles, you can just see almost like a wave go through the spirit of everybody who's there through the power of Aretha's vocal gifts and her sensitivity to her environment. So I think there, you know, those are just examples across my path, but and they, you know, just I have a daughter who's 8 years old, radiant as can be. Her name is Dylan. Dylan, by the way, I'm a sailor, means of the sea in Welsh and Scottish, and my mother was from Scotland. But Dylan just took her school to its feet by singing Good Day Sunshine by the Beatles with a handful of other kids and being very effusive. And the headmistress of the school came up to me and said, I wish I could be as joyous just for one day as she is every day. And so I think that kind of, which am I call, way in which the arts enter the bloodstream is a very, very nourishing and powerful impetus to us to rise to be our best self.
Thank you so much. My next question is that hypothetically, if you had $1 billion right now, how would you spend it and why?
Wow. I guess this is an interesting question because I know a bunch of billionaires who don't think they have very much power. In other words, $1 billion, you could say, there are a lot of people who aren't eating very well right now during this pandemic, and maybe that's the highest and best use to give them comfort and nourishment. But you're not necessarily contributing to systemic change. In other words, after that billion runs out, they're still hungry. So you just postponed a disaster. You didn't make the course change. I guess I don't believe in the United States where I live that $1 billion would be enough money to get all the politicians to reduce the role of money in politics so that you didn't need money to engage in social change. There's a part of me which you've been exploring in this podcast which say maybe you want to create an education film audio production company and disseminate views through what you might call the library of this informal university called INET and allow people. There's one project right now, it's not a $1 billion question, very important in the scheme of things. With the demographic trends, the relative importance of the continent of Africa is going to go way up in the next 40 to 60 years. With the anxiety about migration, my late friend Robert Cayberry was a baker, and he said to me, migration is going to teach economists once and for all that humans are not just factors of production because of the way it unsettles the psychological foundation stones of where people with different traditions come to interact, and that managing that process is very important. But I've often thought in Africa with young people, many of whom by all the surveys, and it is a young demographic there, I think the average age in the continent is about 28 years old now, they need hopeful focal points. There's a new book that's put out by a gentleman named Arkibe, who's been an Ethiopian advisor to the prime minister, John Sender and Chris Kramer at SOAS. Arkibe had gone to SOAS, a London-based school, called African Economic Development. I think on mobile platforms, not relying on internet infrastructure, if you could create a 20-hour course, not in arcane statistical stuff, but in clean lessons and disseminate that through Africa in a way that created an aspiration, a vision in this time where global supply chains and automation mean the what I'll call the East Asian model of development may no longer be applicable. In a time when climate is devastating, climate deterioration is devastating subsistence farming in equatorial regions that creates social instability, helping people find a constructive focal point, helping them bring to bear through organization the pressures necessary to, how I say, form a trajectory of development that is healthy, constructive, and hopeful. That's just an example of what one might do with some of that money. And there are many other questions, obviously, to address. But how would I say, you've got to be humble about this, because the notion of illumination and persuasion is different than action and realization. And both of them are necessary to making that better world.
Certainly, sir. Thank you. Now, to end this remarkable conversation, I'd like to ask you my last and final question. What advice would you give to all those teenage young economists like myself who are listening to this episode, are either in high school or college, and are beginning their odyssey with economics?
I would say that there are several things. One, regardless of where you attend school or whatever, turn yourself into a lifelong learner. And do not, obviously, you have to honor your courses, your grades, and your profile, because that's how society can draw an inference about your preparedness to contribute. But a lot of your lifelong learning is what I call autodidactic. What inspires you, go out, reach for it. Watch the film, get the book, ask an interesting person that you just heard speak. What are they reading? Get, in other words, create what I'll call boundless curiosity within yourself. One of the things that I've done some work with a group around Pope Francis on the question of curriculum, and really at the level of high school, because most people on this planet don't go to college. So this sort of age 15 to 18, if you address things that are real challenges, if you address what they refer to as econophysics. In other words, civics was, what are the institutions of government? Well, what are the institutions of the economy and government that affect your life? So you learn about your world in ways that are relevant. It inspires you to stay in school longer. It overcomes your sense of alienation when the curriculum just doesn't seem to be addressing the things that give you pain in your heart. And so you should bring pressure on the system to evolve what it teaches, because it is using up some of your time. But you can't relinquish your curiosity to what I'll call the rungs in the ladder that somebody else designs. You got to climb yourself. And there are lots of pathways. You've talked about some of the leading thinkers through arts, through music, through inspiration, the Bible, the Quran, the Bhagavad Gita, the Tao Te Ching, Alan Watts. I mean, there are a whole lot of places to, I call, rattle your cage, shake you up, get you to reimagine. And then I guess what I would say is, as frustrating and as frightening as things ever get, I'd encourage everybody to read a book by a man named John O'Neill, or two books by John O'Neill. The first one was just what inspired me to work with him as a life coach, was called The Paradox of Success. And that was the narrow material success and why it was unsatisfying. The second is called Seasons of Grace, that he wrote with a man named Alan Jones, who runs the Grace Cathedral in San Francisco, about how cultivating a state of mind through gratitude. The Vietnamese Buddhist Thich Nhat Hanh has a book called Fear, which is about how to cultivate a resilience of mind, how to nourish the seeds in your spirit, which reduce the crippling nature of fear. There was a psychologist who I don't recall the name of, who wrote a book that essentially said there are only two things that drive us, love and fear. And to diminish fear allows you to have a more a loving kindness kind of spirit, but expressing gratitude is a way of cultivating that energy. So Seasons of Grace by Jones and O'Neill. That's the book I've given away the most in this last year to friends of mine as we're all struggling with the pandemic. And on the last one is a book I just started to read by a woman named Sarah Blondin, lives in British Columbia in Canada, and it's called Heart-Minded. And it's about the struggles between a mind that gets bogged down by fear and reopening. She uses meditation practice, but reopening that curiosity in times of fear. And I think, as I was talking to you earlier about the relationship of arts to economics, there's a heart-mindedness kind of mission or element in the fusion, which I often think the platform of history allows us to explore in that multidisciplinary context, which makes it a great learning environment.
Absolutely brilliant advice, sir. Thank you so much. So that's all of the questions that I had. So thank you so much, sir, once again for speaking with me. To all of the listeners, you should definitely check out the incredible work that the Institute for New Economic Thinking has been doing. The link to their website is www.ineteconomics.org. I'll try to fit in the link somewhere in the description. So check that out and definitely consider joining the Young Scholars Initiative to network with and learn from brilliant economists all around the world. So thank you so much, sir.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
If you like this episode, then please subscribe to this podcast, share with your friends, and follow the Tidings Podcast for more such episodes.